Welcome to the deep dive. We've got a seriously compelling stack of material to get through today.
We really do.
Yeah, if you're the kind of person who loves connecting the dots behind the daily news, but you absolutely hate feeling overwhelmed by the endless flood of information, you are in the exact right place. We've custom-tailored this deep dive just for you.
Exactly. Our mission today is to examine the really complex intersection of power, justice, and transparency in the U.S. legal system.
Right. We're looking at specific mechanisms,
Right.
like how laws are actually applied in the real world, who they apply to, and what happens when public demand for total transparency collides with the reality of, bureaucratic self-preservation.
It's a massive topic, but understanding it is crucial if you want to see how the system operates beneath the surface headlines.
To guide us through this, we're working from a very specific, pointed piece of source material today. We have excerpts from a document titled Lambie HP War on Drugs and Epstein Files 120725 TRA PDF.
Catchy title.
Right. It was authored by a writer identifying himself as a concerned citizen named Brent Lambie. But before we get into the weeds of this text, we need to set the stage regarding the nature of the material we're about to unpack.
We definitely need to establish some ground rules for you, the listener, right up front. The source material we're examining contains some very strong political critiques.
It does.
It specifically targets the Trump administration's policies, its approach to the justice system, and the broader historical operations of the Department of Justice. Our mission in this deep dive is absolutely not to endorse these viewpoints.
Nor are we here to take a political side.
Right. Our goal is simply to impartially unpack the arguments presented in the text, look at the evidence cited, and examine the legal patterns the author identifies. We're laying out the framework of this critique so that you can evaluate these ideas for yourself.
Let's get right into it then. The document opens with a pretty massive claim. It argues that the proclaimed war on drugs didn't just fail to achieve its goals, but that it actually inverted the basic logic of the justice system.
Inverted the logic. It's a strong phrase.
It is. And to help visualize what the text means by this inversion, think about a sports game where the system operates with two entirely different sets of rules.
Okay, I'm tracking.
Imagine a referee harshly penalizing a rookie player for a minor, almost accidental technicality, but then completely turning a blind eye when the team captain commits a flagrant, undeniable foul. The author argues that something very similar to this double standard has become institutionalized within the U.S. justice system.
The document points to a very specific high-profile case to anchor this argument. It brings up Juan Orlando Hernandez, the former president of Honduras.
So, for some vital context, based on the trial records from the Southern District of New York that are cited in the text, and it's worth noting, the Southern District of New York is notoriously one of the most powerful and aggressive federal courts in the country.
Absolutely.
In 2024, a federal jury convicted Hernandez of conspiring to import massive quantities of cocaine into the United States.
And this wasn't a rush trial or a minor possession charge.
Not at all. The text notes this conviction came after years of intense investigation, wiretaps, and witness testimony. Reuters and AP reporting from the time backed up the sheer volume of prosecutors' evidence against him. By all traditional metrics of a war on drugs, taking down a head of state involved in a massive international smuggling ring should be held up as the ultimate victory.
The definitive cautionary tale.
Exactly.
Yet the text draws a really stark contrast here. It notes that instead of being treated as that cautionary tale, Hernandez has actually been portrayed by some figures in Trump's orbit as someone deserving of sympathy or reconsideration.
Which is wild when you think about it.
It highlights a severe cognitive dissonance in the enforcement of the law. You have a convicted head of state, found guilty by a jury of massive drug conspiracy charges after a rigorous trial, receiving political sympathy. Meanwhile, the traditional lower-level targets of drug enforcement face a completely different, unforgiving reality.
And that reality for the less powerful is what the text refers to as the opaque bottom of the system. We go from a former president receiving sympathy straight into some incredibly dark reports regarding overseas interdiction operations.
The document cites investigations from the DOJ's own Office of the Inspector General back in 2017.
Right, along with in-depth reporting from organizations like ProPublica and Human Rights Watch. These reports look at U.S.-linked interdiction operations abroad and out at sea. What exactly is happening in these operations?
The details from these reports are deeply concerning. While the text is careful to note that these reports don't definitively prove unlawful conduct in every single instance, They describe numerous repeated incidents where suspects died during these missions.
Wow.
The critical point the author makes is that these deaths occurred during operations that produced no arrests, no subsequent trials, and no publicly released evidence. Essentially, you have a scenario where a boat is intercepted in international waters, a confrontation occurs, and suspects end up dead without any judicial process ever taking place.
Suspects are ending up dead, and the public doesn't even get to see the evidence of what led to the lethal force.
Wait, why does this matter so much from a constitutional standpoint? I mean, these are international waters, so how does U.S. law even apply there?
It matters immensely because of the foundational laws of the United States and international agreements the U.S. has ratified. The text explicitly cites the Fifth and Sixth Amendments of the U.S. Constitution, which guarantee due process and fair trial rights.
Right. You have to have your day in court.
Exactly. The government can't just bypass the courts. Furthermore, it points to Article 1, Section 8, which reserves the authority to declare war exclusively for Congress, not the executive branch. If lethal force is being used systematically outside of a declared war zone without judicial process, it raises severe constitutional issues.
The government is essentially acting as judge, jury, and executioner in the field.
Precisely the argument being made. The author also brings in international treaties, specifically the Geneva Conventions, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and UN Use of Force Principles. That's a lot of international law to potentially be violating.
It is. These frameworks expressly prohibit the killing of individuals who are not active military combatants or who have not been afforded judicial protections. The argument is that the line between civilian law enforcement and extrajudicial military force has become dangerously blurred, creating a zone where the law simply doesn't protect the accused.
So it's treating a law enforcement operation like a military strike.
Yes.
The document then juxtaposes this incredibly harsh, opaque reality at the bottom with what's happening at the very top of the system. To serve as the ultimate foil to those unproven suspects dying at sea, it introduces the case of Ross Ulbricht.
The Ulbricht case is central to illustrating this inversion of justice.
Let's lay out the facts of that case, based on the DOJ sentencing records from 2015 cited in the text. Ross Ulbricht wasn't just a low-level offender, he created and operated the Silk Road.
For anyone unfamiliar, the Silk Road was a massive dark web marketplace that facilitated millions of dollars in illegal drug sales, weapons trafficking, and other illicit goods.
He was convicted after a full, exhaustive trial. His guilt was definitively established in a federal court of law, and he was sentenced to life in prison.
But then, as noted in the 2021 White House clemency list, Ulbricht received a presidential pardon.
His life sentence was entirely erased through executive clemency.
When you connect these two extremes, the pattern the author is pointing out becomes very stark. On one hand, you have unproven suspects who, according to credible oversight reporting, are facing lethal force without ever seeing the inside of a courtroom.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you have proven high-level offenders like Ulbricht, whose massive guilt has been legally established beyond a reasonable doubt, receiving ultimate mercy through executive power. The argument here is that constitutional limits appear to have become entirely flexible, and that flexibility depends almost entirely on political usefulness or proximity to power.
So if the rules apply differently depending on your status, what does this actually mean for the concept of justice itself?
The text concludes that this is no longer equal justice. It describes a legal hierarchy shaped by influence rather than the rule of law. When executive clemency repeatedly benefits the well-connected or those who become political causes, and the author references analyses of Trump-era clemency patterns by the AP, New York Times, Brookings Institution, and the Harvard Law Review to back this up, it raises a fundamental question.
Right.
Is this truly a justice system enforcing a war on drugs? Or is it a system designed to protect and forgive the powerful while ruthlessly punishing the powerless? The author argues that history will remember this approach, not as tough on crime strength, but as a betrayal of the core American principle of equal justice under the law.
It's a heavy, methodical critique of how influence distorts the legal system. And that concept of a system inherently protecting its own interests brings us into the second half of the document.
Right, the pivot.
The text transitions from the selective application of justice to the mechanisms of transparency. Specifically, it focuses on a piece of legislation called the Epstein Files Transparency Act of 2024.
The author opens this section with a profound sense of skepticism. The text notes that the American public has been told to trust the process far too many times regarding high-level corruption, only for that process to result in sealed court records, missing documents, brick and camera footage, and silence from those in power.
Yeah, the Jeffrey Epstein case is arguably the modern poster child for this kind of institutional distrust.
Absolutely.
Let's break down exactly what this 2024 Transparency Act demands, because on paper it sounds incredibly comprehensive. Based on the congressional text and the summaries provided in the source material, this act requires the Department of Justice to release all unclassified records related to Jeffrey Epstein's investigation and prosecution.
And it gets incredibly specific. We are talking about materials involving his powerful associates, his notorious flight logs, internal DOJ communications about the case, and all documentation surrounding his highly controversial detention and death in federal custody.
The scope of the mandate is massive. It's clearly designed by legislators to shine a light into every single corner of a case that has been plagued by public distrust, legitimate questions, and conspiracy theories for years.
It's an attempt to force the system to bear it all.
And the timeline is aggressively fast. The law mandates that all of these documents must be posted publicly within 30 days. Furthermore, they can't just dump a mountain of unreadable, scanned paper on the public to bury the truth in volume.
Right, the classic document dump.
Exactly. The records have to be released in a searchable and downloadable format. For anyone who has ever tried to comb through government data, you know how crucial that searchable requirement is. It allows citizen journalists, independent researchers, and the general public to use keyword searches to actually parse the data and find connections.
The format mandate is a huge part of the transparency effort. It democratizes the information. But the legislation goes even further with a very specific, fascinating clause regarding why information can or cannot be withheld.
This is the anti-embarrassment clause, and it's a huge deal. The law explicitly states that the Department of Justice is prohibited from withholding or redacting records solely due to embarrassment, reputational harm, or political damage to public officials.
They cannot hide the truth just because it makes powerful people look terrible.
Whether they're in government or the private sector.
Which is exactly what the public has been demanding an end to institutional cover-ups designed to protect reputations. However, the text is careful to detail what redactions are legally permitted under the act, because no transparency law is absolute.
Right.
The DOJ is allowed to redact personally identifiable information, or PII, of the victims to protect their privacy. They must, of course, redact any child sexual abuse materials. And they are permitted to redact content that could compromise ongoing active investigations.
Which all seems entirely reasonable. You have to protect the victims, and you can't blow up an active sting operation. But the author isn't writing this section to praise the legislation, are they?
No, they're writing to point out a massive, glaring vulnerability in how this law is actually executed.
This is the crux of the second argument.
The document points out that while the law forcefully dictates what must be released and what cannot be withheld for political reasons, it provides absolutely no forensic audit to ensure the records haven't been altered or erased before they are published.
Wait, let me make sure I'm wrapping my head around this. The law forces the DOJ to release everything, but there's no independent outside audit to check if files were quietly deleted before the 30-day clock even started.
That's exactly it.
They're essentially grading their own homework.
That's the exact vulnerability the author is highlighting. The legislation operates on a massive assumption. It assumes that the very agency that has held these records in secret for years, an agency that the author argues has a long history of managing illusions of truth, rather than providing the truth itself, will simply hand over everything completely unedited and intact, entirely on the honor system.
It's asking the FOSS to audit the hen house and report back on how many chickens are left.
It is. The concern laid out in the text is that without a forensic audit, meaning without independent third-party verification of the digital integrity of the servers and files before the DOJ processes them for release, the public has no way of knowing if the most damning pieces of evidence were simply wiped.
Yeah.
The author argues that this specific moment in history is not about partisan politics. It's about whether a justice system that has fundamentally failed victims for decades can suddenly be trusted to reveal the full truth on its own, especially when that truth might implicate its own ranks or powerful allies.
As the document powerfully states, America does not need another promise of transparency from these institutions. It needs verifiable proof.
It's a really devastating critique of the actual mechanisms of transparency.
So, as we look at both of these extensive sources, the critique of the war on drugs and the deep dive into the Epstein Files Transparency Act, what is the overarching theme tying this all together?
If we synthesize both halves of this document, the overarching theme is about a legal and bureaucratic hierarchy that is shaped almost entirely by influence, rather than the ideal of equal justice under the law.
Right.
In the first section, we see this through the lens of enforcement. We see how a convicted former head of state might receive political sympathy, and a convicted dark web kingpin might receive a full pardon, while unnamed, powerless suspects overseas face lethal force without ever seeing a trial. The application of the law bends, stretches, or breaks to accommodate power.
And then, in the second section, we see this exact same dynamic through the lens of transparency.
We see how a sweeping historic law designed to expose the powerful contains a structural blind spot, the lack of an independent forensic audit. That blind spot ultimately leaves the curation of the truth entirely in the hands of the very system being scrutinized. In both cases, whether applying punishment or releasing secrets, the mechanism of justice appears engineered to protect the influential while demanding complete, unquestioning submission from the public.
And this is exactly why analyzing these specific, detailed documents matters so much for you, our listener. If you want to be well-informed without getting lost in the noise and the outrage of the daily news cycle, understanding these systemic mechanisms is everything.
It really is.
When you hear about a high-profile executive pardon on the news or a new sweeping transparency law passing through Congress, you now have a much sharper lens to view those headlines. It isn't just about what the law says on paper or what the press release claims. It's about asking how that clemency is actually applied behind the scenes.
Exactly.
It's about looking for the specific mechanical loopholes, like the absence of a forensic audit in a transparency mandate. Understanding this helps you look past the political theater and ask the right critical questions about the actual process of justice in this country.
It gives you the tools to move beyond the superficial narrative. You start examining the structural realities of how power sustains itself and protects itself through the very legal system designed to hold it accountable.
Well, this has been an incredibly thought-provoking journey today. We've unpacked the paradoxes of the justice system, the glaring disparities in how the law is applied based on influence, and the hidden structural vulnerabilities in our demands for public transparency. Thank you so much to you, the listener, for bringing such compelling and complex material to the table for us to dive into.
Before we go, I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over, something that builds directly on the critique of the Eckstein Act we just discussed.
Okay.
If landmark transparency laws ultimately rely on the very agencies being investigated to honestly curate and release their own records, can true transparency ever actually be legislated? Or does a system built to protect power inherently protect itself, leaving us to wonder what happens when the custodians of the truth are the ones with the most to lose from it?
That is a question that will definitely stick with you long after we sign off. Thank you again for joining us for this deep dive. Keep digging, keep questioning the headlines, and please keep bringing us these great sources to explore. We'll catch you next time.